ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय उद्यतस्य हि कामस्य प्रतिवाद न शश्यते अपि निर्मुक्त सङ्गस्य काम रक्तस्य किं पुनः उद्यतस्य हि कामस्य प्रतिवादो न शश्यते अभिनिर्मुक्तसङ्गस्य कामरक्तस्य किं पुनः उद्यतस्य हि कामस्य प्रतिवादो न शश्यते अभिनिर्मुक्तसङ्गस्य कामरक्तस्य किं पुनः उद्यतस्य हि कामस्य प्रतिवारो न शश्यते अभिनिर्मुक्तसङ्गस्य कामरक्तस्य किं पुनः Translation. To deny an offering that has come of itself is not commendable even for one absolutely free from all attachment, much less one addicted to sensual pleasure. Purport. In material life, everyone is desirous of sense gratification. Therefore, a person who gets an object of sense gratification without endeavor should not refuse to accept it. Kardama Muni was not meant for sense gratification. Yet he aspired to marry and prayed to the Lord for a suitable wife. This was known to Swayambhuva Manu. He indirectly convinced Kardama Muni, "You desire a suitable wife like my daughter, and she is now present before you. You should not reject the fulfillment of your prayer. You should accept my daughter." When one has a desire, something that is, you know, proper, then when the fulfillment of that desire comes, then it should be accepted. Otherwise, then, many times, due to that desire, we have a particular way that we feel it should work. And then the problem is we don't accept that. And then we go on and on and on. And so we never actually get what we're looking for. So, especially here, Kardama Muni, you know, this is known as Amrita. We're accepting things that come on their own accord. So, living by that manner, then naturally also he has prayed for wife here. And then that should, then when the suitable wife comes, then he's accepting. Not that he thinks, well, this one's not perfect, and this one's not perfect, and that one's not perfect, and this one's not perfect, until after a while, then the boy is starting to put henna in his hair, and you know, like this. And I've seen myself. One person, he was from, I think, 76. He was trying to get married. There was some opportunity. He wouldn't accept that one. He wanted a different one. And to today, you know, he's still, you know, trying to dress himself to still look proper and attractive. You know, that's what, 26 years later. So, you know, so, not sure what he's looking for now, but. So, this should be avoided. Is that something that is necessary, that's fitting to one's situation, then that should be accepted. Like that. And if not, I mean, if it's not suitable to one's situation, then it is not accepted. But if it is, then it should be accepted, not thinking, well, I won't take this, I'll get something else later. So this is an important thing. When things come, they should be accepted. Like that. Especially, yeah, like this kind of situation. But otherwise, if it's things, then they're accepted, and then if one finds that they're not suitable or that one doesn't require, then one gives them in charity. Like the brahmanas, they would go to the king and ask for charity, and then he might give them 10,000 cows. So it's very rare you find a brahman who needs 10,000 cows. But he would accept those 10,000 and then keep what he needs and give the rest in charity. So that aspect is also there. So both of these points are here. Okay. Any questions on this? Yeah.
How is it that Swami Vivekananda knew from Adam and Eve's desire? Was that she talking just mystical understanding?
Not sure. That I can't say. It doesn't mention here. Like that. It may have been that he knew that he was going to. It may be whether he knew exactly what he said, but it may have been known that he was going to perform austerities to get the darshan of the Lord and ask him for a suitable wife. Or it could have been that, you know, the pastimes of the Lord then may be known to so many persons. Because being the son of Brahma, then Brahma may have known about it, because Brahma lives with the thousand-armed Vishnu, like that. There's a form, thousand-headed Vishnu. He stays with Lord Brahma. And so he might have told him, and this way it got known. You know, so many ways it could have been. That's not the main point here. That might be, that story might, you might find in some other Purana. But here the essential thing is, the Bhagavatam always talks about the relationships, you know, that are going on. So that's the essential point for here. He knew about it, so therefore he was very confident to make this point.
In relation, I was thinking, looking for suitable compatibility for one's daughter, should one be aware of someone who's looking for a marriage?
Yeah. No. In marriage, see, there's eight kinds of marriages. So four are approved by the father of the girl, and four, you know, basically doesn't really have much to do with it. So the four that are approved, those are considered good. Those give the children that are considered of better quality. They'll be more pure. Those that come from the four inferior ones may have you know, some kind of blemish in their character, like that. So of the four that are considered proper, then the best of them, which is called the Brahma marriage, that means where the father makes an endeavor and finds a suitable candidate for his daughter. That's considered the best. Then next best is that he hadn't made a particular endeavor to find the boy, but the boy happened to be the priest at a function which he was sponsoring. And by working with that priest, he could understand that he was a suitable candidate. Then you have, if the father is unable to find someone, then the daughter, through her friends and relatives, gets them to find, you know, make some arrangement. Or in the case of, like we see in the kings, then the Swayambar, she chooses herself. But it's under the arrangement and approval of her father. So that's called Prajapatya. And then the last of those four is where the boy's side of the family approaches the girl's side of the family. And after giving kind of a tribute of respect to the family, and the approval of the father, then they are married. So those four are considered good. So the arrangement of the father, or the involvement of the father, is important. So the more he's involved, the better it is. Like that. Because the idea is the father, having affection for the daughter, wants to see that she gets, you know, a suitable arrangements like what he is able to offer. Mm-hmm. So he wants to see that, you know, the standard of living is maintained. Standard of relationships and all that. So that's why he then takes a personal interest in the arrangement. like that, then the four blamable ones, then you have the asura. No, I think first is rakshasa. Yeah, rakshasa, where the boy comes into the house and after, you know, breaking down the doors and stealing the girl and, you know, killing whoever gets in the way, then he, you know, makes off with the girl. So that's popular amongst rakshasas and applicable to kings. You know, princes can use that one. Then the worst of them, which means not the worst, it's one of the two worst. Well, I'd say, okay, we'll put the next is then Gandharva. Gandharva is then considered where there's mutual consent between the boy and girl. The parents have nothing to do with it. It's just simply mutual attraction. So then that is there. It's great amongst Gandharvas. That's their method. But amongst humans, it's not recommended. Kings can use it, but it's considered not as good. Then the next one is asura, which means that the boys say the family comes and pays a big amount of money, and in this way then basically buys the girl like this. So this is very, very popular kind of in the Central Asia and the Middle East like that. I'm not sure of other places, but generally amongst those who are following the Mohammedan religion, this is, they're probably more popular of all the marriage rites. The problem with that one is then it comes across that the father or the family members are selling the girl. So it's considered a bit mercenary like that. Then the last of them is called paisach. So that's also avoided when the girl is, you know, somehow or another disoriented, either due to sleep or you know, some kind of emotional distress or intoxication or some way where she doesn't know what's going on, and the boy comes in and catches her like that. So that these are the eight kinds of marriages. So six are usable for humans, two are not, and of those six, two are not recommended. So that leaves only the four. So that means the father should be involved in the process. Like that. Does that make some sense? Yeah. Anything else on this? Or? Yes?
It's not actually much. It's diversity. When you mentioned the 1,000 hours of diversion, the one who was discussing in class the other day, who was it in the church?
No. Shirodaksha, 1,000 arms is an expansion of Garbhodaksha Vishnu. Kirodaksha Vishnu enters into everything. So he's the one that sits at Svetadvip. Like that, the pole star where Dhruva Maharaj is the king. So that's the Vaikuntha planet. The universal form is an expansion of Garbhodaksha Vishnu. He's the one that enters into everything. But he's not entering, he's entering as his energies. This is the difference. Paramatma is entering everything in his form and is staying there to guide the wanderings of all the living entities. But Garbhodaksha Vishnu has entered as putting his potency into everything so that it has that attractive feature and it does what it's supposed to do. Like that. So let's say, attraction to something. We go to the forest and we find it very beautiful. That beauty, that's Garbhodaksha Vishnu, not Supersoul. Supersoul is in the heart of all those trees and plants and birds and all that. But the actual potency that makes the nature beautiful or the sunrise or gives that power to the sun or to the moon or like that, that's coming from Garbhodaksha Vishnu. So that form in which he enters everything, like that, that's the 1,000 arm form. The Purusha Shukta talks about Sahasra Shirsha Purusha Sahasraksha Sahasrapat. 1,000 heads, thousands of arms, 1,000 legs. So that form then lives with Lord Brahma. Because he created everything, so then he lives with him. Okay? Anything else? Yes?
Following from a question that it looks like the responsibility of marriage is more towards the girl's parents, which is
special. Yes, it's fully on the girl's parents.
Yeah, you don't have to worry.
It means if they just want to sit around, it means they have to see who's there, but it's the father's arrangement.
So, it is not a responsibility of the wife's father to look for
him. Means he should be looking. Means they can make contact, but it has to be the it is approved by the father of the girl, because the actual marriage arrangements are made by the girl's father. But it doesn't mean that the boy's side of the family hasn't contacted. Like that. But generally...
He should be initiated by those parents.
Generally, it means the actual, you know, making it happen is there. It might be suggested by the other side, but generally it's done by the girl's side, you know. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen by the other, you know. But generally is, you know, in a community, you know, everybody knows who's there. Like that. So it's not that it's not known. You know, everybody knows who's around, who's available, and this and that. You know? You know?
Sunday feast.
Yeah. Things just like Sunday feast, Kartik and Vrindavan. Yeah, I mean, all these places you can find, you know, suitable matches.
That's a good place to be.
Yeah, that's good. Oh, okay. You've already checked. Okay, so, you know, because women are aware of all these things, and so then the wife will tell the husband and tell him to go talk. Like that. So there, all these things are seen. But generally we see, historically, it's a girl's side of the family that does the looking. Like that. Because the boys, you know, it means generally they're busy with education and stuff like that. Like that. But it's a duty of the parents. Is that okay?
As you were talking about the importance of compatibility in the Vedic system and girls married by puberty, and you also mentioned that nowadays people's natures are really uncertain. So what's the practical kind of solution in society that we have today, where if you marry somebody at the age of 13, by the time they're 19, there could be someone else?
No, if who they are at 13, they'll be at 19. I mean, these girls, what they are at 13 is what they're going to be at 19. If they don't get married at that age, then they turn into something else. Like that. And then sometimes if the experience before was okay, means their family situation was okay before, then generally sometime like that or in their 20s, they kind of turn back into the same person again. But otherwise, they can kind of check out for a few years. Like that. The main thing is now is that kind of arrangement is not happening. You know, generally it's not legal, so therefore, you know, the girls, they stay, they do their education and go on. But if the family is strong, the relationships are strong, then they can keep it together up until marriage. Like that. That's one side of it. The other is that ideally is if there's, you know, people are living in families, then the families can see each other and figure out. But if you don't have that, then other authorities should try to figure it out. And if need, you have to go to the extent of, you know, like interviews or filling out forms, something to figure out what's in their head, you know. Because the point is if you put boy and girl together, then it's always okay. There's some magical chemicals at work, and you just put two of them together, unless it's really obviously different, then if it's anywhere within a kind of like a similar ballpark, you know, which can be quite big, then it's always nice. It'll always be because they feel happy, so it'll eternally be nice, you know. But generally that kind of euphoria, you know, goes away. How you say, maximum, you know, kind of like 6 months after marriage, or once a girl gets pregnant, like this, sometimes sooner. And then it's kind of like you really wonder who you're married to. So that's why it's very difficult. If they can talk amongst themselves, great, but it's not a guaranteed option, you know, that it'll work. So it's better that others talk than find out. You know, the main thing, you have to find out what are their values in the marriage, what they're looking for, what they're expecting, what they're willing to, you know, do. You know, lifestyle, how they're going to live, the temple devotees outside, how they'll make their living, you know, how they're going to spend their money, what kind of facilities they're going to live in, children, how many children, how they'll be educated. These are things that, you know, you wouldn't think to think about. But that's why before you just go and see the other family and you can see how they live, how they've trained, what kind, then you know that's the standard. But nowadays it's hard to tell by that because there is no tradition. Yeah.
It seems that one of the dangers of interviews, and you touched on it yesterday, is that people might have their theoretical values that they put on paper, that they say is what they want to achieve in life, but if you look at their activities, you can see that actually their lifestyle isn't exactly in line with the values.
Yeah, you have to see that, you have to check the charts. You know, you'd have to ask the legend to check. But the point is that unless someone is thinking that there's a particular person they want, or then they're not going to answer. It means they're going to, if they're not thinking of anyone in particular, or if they're looking for someone like them, they're going to answer as they understand it themselves. If they're thinking about catching a particular person or a particular group of persons, then they may answer differently, like that. But if you don't know what's available, then generally the tendency is you will answer according to your own nature, you know, unless you're embarrassed about it, you know.
I was thinking of an example. Maybe myself could be an example. I might say that I want to live very simply, but, you know, I always have gadgets and things like that. So on the one hand, it's kind of like the value that I'm aspiring towards, but in reality, my nature's more inclined towards computers and things. So therefore, if you just look at what's on the paper and you don't see how the person actually lives, then you know, you might not really get the real story.
Yeah, well, that's why before they would go to their houses and see. They'd see them, you know, in their natural environment. Like that. You know, because that's how you can tell a lot. Yeah. You know, that's going to be told. But it's a good point. But at least that's what they're trying to get to. And if they maintain that as a value, at least it's a progressive to get to. But still, it is a problem because how long it takes to get to that. Same time as what is the definition. The proper thing would be is you want to live simply, but then what is the definition of simplicity? That's also because everybody may have a difference. It means you go to, let's say, generally those who are established rich, not those who are newly rich, but established rich. You go to their houses, so they're very big and spacious. They're very simple inside. They never overclutter it. They just put just how much is necessary to make that room function. They don't put more. So in one sense, it is simple. Like that. So you'd have to see then what is their definition of simplicity. You know, you just want to live on a very simple and, you know, peaceful, you know, 1,000-acre, you know, plot of land, you know, like that. And, you know, just enough rooms, you know, a house of just enough rooms, you know, like that. Not too overdone, you know, 100 should be enough, you know. You know, 1,000 like in Versailles, a little overdoing it, you know. But, 100 would be enough, you know. So then you understand what their definition of simplicity is. You know, so your definition is only one computer, not one for each hand. You know, that may be a bit too much. Anything else? Yeah.
Maybe this is out of today's topic, but I would give that chapter 7 text for one thing. Srila Prabhupada writes in the paper that the super soul is not attained on the spiritual world. Can you please explain this to me?
The super soul is not eternal in the spiritual world. Yes, because super soul means in the spiritual world, then you're living with the Lord. So there's no need of super soul. Here we come here, we forget the Lord. So then means this, you can't separate the Lord and the living entity. So the Lord comes as super soul. like that. So the manifestation of super soul is only within the material world. In the spiritual world, the super soul is in front of you.
So when a person leaves the body, what things go with the soul?
What go with the soul? Well, it goes, his mind goes, his intelligence goes, his ego goes, the karna sharir, or the material, the primordial material desire to be the controller and enjoyer of the, you know, everything he can come in contact with, his unlimited material desires, and the super soul.
Super soul also goes.
Yeah.
So that's what I don't understand. So if the super
soul
goes,
that's when he goes, you know, in the material world, not when he goes back to Godhead. When he goes back to Godhead, all that goes is the soul. Nothing else goes. Okay. But when he changes bodies in the material world, then all that extra baggage goes with him. You know, it's like moving house. What goes when you move house? You leave the house, you take everything else. Right? Like that. So that's all you just, that's all you're doing is changing house. But when you leave the material world, then only the soul goes. Yes.
What is the profession of grihastha?
What is the?
Perfection of the grihastha.
The perfection of grihastha is to become Krishna conscious. That's what one is trying to do. You can see in the purport in not sure what canto, in the story of what's it, Pachina Barhishap, there's that whole analogy. Fourth canto. And what's the king? Paranjana. Yeah, so Paranjana becomes a woman. So then it becomes Vidarbhi, Queen Vidarbhi, and marries Maharaj Malayadwaj. So then when he leaves his body and she's preparing the funeral pyre and everything, in that purport then it explains how the husband and wife, then they can become Paramahamsas, and you know that's the perfection, is to get to that platform. So that means they have to go from the stage of Sakam Karma Yoga, means of doing their activities for Krishna but based on their own material desire, you know, and the fruits that they want, and then connecting those fruits to Krishna once they get them, to the platform of performing the activities according to what Krishna says should be done for Krishna's pleasure. That's the Nishkam Karma Yoga. Okay. And then from that they can get to the platform of liberation. Like that. So that's the actual perfection, is to come to the point of, you know, becoming Krishna conscious. Right? But that won't happen unless one is engaging all one's activities in Krishna's service. Understand? It means just to put a man and woman together doesn't guarantee Krishna consciousness. Right? You know, unless they're together and everything that they do is based on Krishna consciousness. All their interactions are based on the, you know, Krishna conscious culture, on these rules and the, you know, the culture given in the Vedic literature, like that, for pleasing Krishna. That will then free one from the material contamination. Right? It won't give you love for Krishna. It'll free you from the material world. Right? So along with that, then you have to cultivate, you know, one's attraction for Krishna through the process of chanting and hearing and worshipping the Lord. Is that okay?
Last night you were talking about training children and how we can get in the mentality of thinking the children are supposed to be submissive to us, so therefore we administrate them. I think you used that term. We can box them around and bark at them.
Mm-hmm.
And you're suggesting that rather that we should develop a relationship and train them in that way. Could you explain more about how that would be done?
It means what's the center is the main thing. Is that if the child's training is the focus of the relationship, then it'll be very different than it's the pleasure of the parents. Like that. If the parents see their children as objects of pleasure, then naturally then there's going to be frustration when they're not pleasurable, when they misbehave. Because the parents have that mood, the children will pick that up. One, they'll be conceived in that mood. So then naturally they'll be conceived in a mood that they take others as their source of sense gratification, and themselves as the center of that sense gratification. So they'll be, that will be their, you know, generic makeup. Then besides that, then that'll get its, you know, support from just the mood and activities of the parents, the way they deal. So general tendency is children like that will tend to get spoiled. And then when they get spoiled, naturally then they start to frustrate the parents, because then a spoiled child is not, you can't enjoy. And then that just deepens the whole problem. So the parents get more frustrated and pulled back to themselves. The child becomes more self-centered because he's not getting any attention. And it just becomes worse. But if the purpose is to train the child, you know, for the child's benefit, then means you're establishing a relationship. So in that relationship, one may use, you know, pleasantness or that mood of authority or logic or emotion or whatever needs to be done for the particular situation that is, will get the point across to the child, like that. You know, then it doesn't mind. You know, if the parents are very strict, the child doesn't mind if the relationship is very close. But if the relationship's not close, even if they're very liberal or, you know, very indulging, the child won't be happy.
That's it. Okay. And then as the children grow up, in the Vedas it talks about, you know, at the age of 5 you should become very strict, and then about 15 or 16 you become a friend.
16. Yeah, see, up to the age of 5, means strict means is then they have to be regulated. Up to the age of 5, if they're not regulated, it doesn't matter. But it doesn't mean that they're allowed to do anything that is against the culture, that's improper as far as behavior goes. You know, it's proper dealings with others. It means they eat anytime they want, you know, they get upset, they may cry, they sleep anytime they want, you know, that, you know, these kind of things. That you just have to work with. But from the age of 5, then they can be trained in regularity. So they only eat at these times, they only sleep at these times, they only do these things like that. So you have to gear them into that. You know, it may take a little practice, but that has to be the direction they go. And they can do it. It's not a difficulty. It's just a matter of if the parents value it, they can get it across to the children. If they don't value it, they can't. That's the thing. So then that becomes, yeah, that's an important aspect. So then that strictness in that has to be there through till 15. Then from 16, then one deals more as a friend, though one's a senior friend, but still it's more on the friendship level rather than as an adult and a child like that. Because at 16, they change their perspective. A 15-year-old is the biggest kid. 16-year-old is the smallest adult. And up to 15, they kind of look down. So they're the biggest guy. But at 16, they start to look up, you know, and see that, you know, where they're going. What's their, you know, that's when they all start to figure out who they are, where they're going. So from that time also, then you can start teaching philosophy very seriously.
Is it for boys only or for girls also?
It would be both. It means the general flavors are the same amongst both. Though there is the point is the girls are more aware and more, they're more aware of interactions, duties, what's going on around them. So generally you can see girls by 9 years old, 8, 9 years old, they can be quite serious in Krishna consciousness. And they can be very dutiful and all that. If they're trained in that and supported in that, then that will continue. If they're not, then you know, if it's more self-centered, then they just know they get attention if they behave like that. And then when they hit puberty, they may or may not maintain it. So one has to be careful of that. You know, boys have to be made aware. Girls are aware. It has to be then refined. It means their awareness has to be turned into, you know, the proper view of it. It means they have the view. They have the ability to see.
you know, what's going on around them, but they have to be trained what is the proper way to values in that. They have to be given a value system in that. Well, the boys don't necessarily see, they have to be trained to see and then given a value system and why they should, you know, do that. So both of them must be given a value system, but one is one has to be trained outside the home, one is trained in the home. Like that. The reason the boys have to be taken out of the home is they don't become conscious in the home. You know, it's some magic, mystical thing that their room gets cleaned up, clothes get washed, food gets on the table. You know, there's always something around and happening and this and that. And doesn't matter what they do when, you know, they come into the house, make a mess of it, leave. When they come back, by magic, it's all nice again. You know, they go in and eat everything in the refrigerator and come back later, and by magic, things are there again. So, therefore, they have to be taken out of the house and put into the under the care of. It means they have to be children are trained in the parental rasa, but the boys have to change from the biological parental rasa to the teacher as parent in that rasa. And then in there, he becomes conscious of things because then he washes his own clothes, he cleans the room himself, he does the cook, he does all these things. Then he becomes aware, oh, things become edible because people go into the kitchen and cut things, boil things, fry things. You know, clothes get washed because you put them in buckets with soap and do all these things. So, you know, then from that step, you get them into conscious of what's going on around them, other people, the environment. So then you teach them in all the levels of consciousness this way. You take them through anamoy, pranamoy, manamoy, gyanamoy, like this. Well, the girls are naturally aware of things, but there means so naturally up to the level of emotion, up to the manamoy, they'll be, you know, aware. But they have to be trained. What is that manamoy? So religious principles, religious activities, religious standards is actually very easier to teach girls. It's the kind of thing they can relate to easily. Boys, it has to be intellectually taught to them. Like that. The girls, it's a natural thing for them. But they have to be taught to go beyond that to the transcendental. Like that. So to be aware of beyond that, the soul and God. You know, in a religious way, they see it. But the purpose of all that still comes back to the center of the manamoy, of you know, pious relationships, nice relationships. Automatically, then that means there'll be economic development. So facilities will be there, and then sense gratification. So that's kind of their sphere. While the boys, you know, but then the boys, it's more natural because of the logic to go from manamoy to vijnanamoy, to understanding the soul. So the jnana marg is more, they can relate to more. And then from there to the transcendence. So both have to be trained. So that center point is there. Is that one has to be made aware of it, the other is aware of it. But it's not, you know, it hasn't been understood like that. Because if they don't understand it, then there's a chance to slide from it. But you don't, because for women, the emotions and the senses are connected. There's no, though for them and their perception, there's not really a difference. When the emotions are engaged, the senses are automatically engaged. The mother has great affection for the child, so automatically she's touching, feeding, doing these things. They go together. So as long as it's coming from the platform of religion down, it's good, it's pious. It's called mother. But if it goes from down to up, it's called tigress. Is they have their senses, they want to enjoy their senses, but they do that through their emotional things. They catch the men, they do this and that, and, you know, get what they want. So it's not a natural form. Like that. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
In the case of this training, you have one on one hand the teaching, on the other side the learning.
Yes. So,
Does this happen simultaneously, or is there a time lag between the teaching and the learning? Or could there be teaching and there's no learning, or there could be learning without any teaching?
You're talking about one person or two people?
Well, I mean, generally, generally in terms of training, I mean, there's one side of teaching and the learning.
When you say one side's teaching, that means you mean one person?
It could be one person or it could be
No, I'm just saying you're talking about people. Yeah, you're talking about a teacher and you're talking about a student.
Yes. Must it happen simultaneously or is there a time lag between it?
No, it always goes
on. Or could there be learning without any teaching or could there be...
There can't be learning without some teaching. Means you have to put in the elements of knowledge. Then after that you can learn by one's own study, one's own experience, like that. But something has to be put in to make you aware of the elements of the subject. Otherwise you don't know. Once you know, just like mathematics, once you know how numbers work and the arithmetic system works, then on your own you can expand and go this way and find out so many things. But until you understand numbers, or until you understand, letters and words and all that, then you can't explore writing. Right? So creative writing is based on that you've put in the knowledge of reading. And basic writing. Once that's in, then you can draw out. It's a difficulty. In the Vedas, the two went together. In the modern, then you get some who emphasize that you have to teach the children by rote, and others who say that you have to draw from the child. But you can't draw anything until you put something in. Like that.
Well, teaching must begin first, and then learning occurs later.
It's just simultaneous. When you teach, it means you can't call it teaching if somebody didn't learn. If the teacher stands there and says all kinds of things and the students didn't understand anything, you can't say he's teaching. He's not teaching. He's talking, but he's not teaching.
But we said yesterday that we can teach and the student doesn't learn because it doesn't have the nature. And it's not a fault of the teacher because the student...
Yes, but that's another... We have to... How you say? I guess the saying would be... You give a certain example to support a certain angle that you're looking at. You can't necessarily apply one example to another situation. Right? If you want to study what is a student, then you talk about the teacher in one way. If you want to talk about what's a teacher, then you talk about the teacher in a different way. Right? You understand that? No, okay. Let us take a father and son relationship. Okay, so now let's discuss the father from the son's angle. He's the authority. He's the person you surrender to. So each will have a different mood. Right? Or like the guru and disciple. The disciple sees the guru as his source of liberation. The guru doesn't think, yes, I'm his source of liberation. He thinks, no, my guru is his source of liberation. I am simply giving the knowledge of liberation that my guru gives, and that will free the disciple. But if the guru thinks, yes, I'm liberating the disciple, then he's not the one liberating. The disciple actually liberates the guru. You understand? So you have to be able to distinguish between the two. When we're discussing natures of students, then we're talking that if the student doesn't have the potential, you can't draw anything out. Right? So the potential needs to be there. Then you put in the elements to make them aware of what is that field of knowledge. Then you can get them to contemplate it and practice it. That's the process of drawing it out. Then from there, the next stage is realization. Right? So we're talking about suitability of matching a teacher and a student, or a student and a subject matter. So that means teacher and student. We're not talking about the process of teaching. That's a different thing. That's a subject matter for a teacher on themselves. The other is for what is a suitable candidate as a student. So they're two different topics. So you can't mix them and then... They're related, but you can't use the example of one and the other. Right? Because the teacher is teaching while the other students are there. Of course, if you want to say, if he wants to teach that one particular person, but then is that the right environment? You understand? Is that the environment for that student? The teacher has 10 students, all of them understand, one doesn't understand. Maybe that's not the environment for that one. Either he has to be in a different environment in the same subject, move it in a different way, or he doesn't belong in that subject. Does that make some sense?
So you are indicating the technique of teaching is also very important.
Yes. But see, in this kind of conversation, it's very important I know what you're trying to get at. Right? Otherwise, I can't answer.
Oh,
if it's an observation, yes. Yes. If it's an observation, yes. But it's very, very. If you have a very specific point you want to get to, if you ask a specific question on it, then you get. But otherwise, I mean, if it's a general discussion, then it doesn't matter.
Just looking at learning and teaching, you know, I mean, you have one fact, the learning and teaching. Sometimes you find that there's a lot of teaching and then there's no learning.
Yeah, it means it's called teaching, but unless the student learns, it's not called teaching. But if the student is able to learn. But if the student's not able to learn that, then the teacher may be teaching, but the student doesn't have the qualification. So it just depends upon what is there. That's why you have to match. Same as the relationships, you have to match. So husband and wife, you have to match. Student and teacher, you have to match. You know, the authority and the citizens has to be matched. You know, like his friends, you have to match. You have to have, there has to be something in common. You know, so if there is something in common and the student's not learning, means that the teacher needs to adjust something. They're moving too fast, or it's too obscure, or too esoteric, or something is there. You know, the example didn't catch the example, or you know, or there was some other points they didn't know, and the teacher's already teaching. He either took it for granted they knew. You know, they came from another class or another school, or you know, so he figured they would already know that. They don't. He has to go back and give those fundamental points, like that. You know, so one has to see that. So there must be a commonality between the teacher and student, that the teacher has a value of the topic he teaches and is able to get it across to others, and that the student has a potential for learning that topic and a value for that topic. Then you have something serious. If the teacher doesn't value the topic, he can't really teach it. He can get it across, but you won't get across the value. Getting across the value is the most important thing, because if you value it, you'll use it. Otherwise, the teacher gets across the math, but they themselves aren't particularly interested in math, then the student will also be not particularly interested. And then they may not take it seriously or not apply it when they need it. You know, just like in the Vedic, the modern thing is that how you say, in the Vedic is that those who are best in the field taught that aspect of the field. So when the prince, after you know, he learned the philosophy and the scriptures from the Brahmins who were best at that. Then when he wanted to learn about the practical application of their duties, like say economics, then he would learn from the minister of the kingdom who dealt with the economics, the treasury and all those things. He would learn, you know, the warfare from the generals. You know, he would learn, you know, the political sciences from, you know, the prime minister and from the Rajguru. Like this. He would learn all how to behave and all that. He'd learn from the priest. And so he would, you know, on the job, learn all these different things from the best that there is available. So that was the Vedic system. You wanted to learn carpenter, you learn it from a carpenter. You know, someone who's making their job at it. You go and work in a workshop that's actually producing, you know, furniture and that, you learn. Because they're doing it. They're making money out of it. If they don't do it right, and they don't do it properly, they're not going to make money. So you'll learn carpentry the best there. Well, if you go into, you know, a wood shop and you make a little box or something like that, it's nice. You get a kind of feel for the field. You know what's involved in the field, but it doesn't necessarily draw out of you the ability to do carpentry or value it. That you'll get from a person who has that value. Right? So if you can get your teachers have those, then that's the best. The person who teaches, let's say, writing. They value writing. They're themselves a writer. They like to write. So then they'll be able to actually bring out creative writing from the student. because they're inspired by it, so they can inspire the students. If they don't, it's just something to be done, and they can get across the fundamentals that it's something you must know and it must be done, and they're students. So maybe if the student himself personally has that, then on his own, from his own studies or finding other people, he'll be inspired. Does that make some sense? Like that. So you have to look at it, you know, what's a qualified student? Because that's how the Vedas go through it. See, we're talking already in application, but the Vedas go through what is a qualified teacher. Then it goes through what's a qualified student. Then it goes through what are the activities of a student that make them then therefore able to learn. Then it puts them together. So we talk of the classroom situation after we've already identified teacher, student, and lifestyle of both of them. Once that's established, then we can talk about the classroom. Does that make sense? Like that. Otherwise, then there's so many of these things that means once you've established those, then we talk about the classroom. It's already understood. You know, those basic points of studentship, teachership, like that. Is that okay? Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
It's interesting in Sanskrit when you analyze teaching and learning.
Mm.
In Sanskrit, one Sanskrit word for learning is patati, you know, read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the word for teaching is patayati, which means to get somebody to learn. So if they didn't learn, then they didn't teach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's fair. Yeah, it means it has to be practical, they have to.
This costless mercy of the guru or the teacher coming to the beginning of this situation in training the teacher
means that the teacher is spending that time to teach the student. He's going out of his way. It means the service that the teacher is doing for the student is not balanced by the student's service to the teacher. Like that. Understand? The thought and the endeavor that goes into teaching the child something is not matched by the child swept and wiped the floor. Right? Because the child is not necessarily conscious of what's... They just know they have to do it. Therefore, we see is those students who are aware, they're the ones that are talked about in the scriptures as exemplary. You know? Like that. And also those teachers who are having that mood. You know, if it's just something that makes money for them, then of course they'll just do it just enough to maintain their position. Unless they want to, you know, they're a little bit, they want to move up, then they'll do better so that they move up. But you want a teacher who actually wants to teach. He wants to see that the students benefit. They actually gain from that knowledge. They value the knowledge. They're able to apply that knowledge. Like you see, much of it is a weakness, much in the modern situations, you're taught, but you're not taught to apply it or to value it. Some teachers do, they who themselves, and many don't. And so then you have students who come out of the school and they don't really know what they can do with their knowledge. They have knowledge, but they can't do anything with it because they haven't been given like that value of it. You understand? So they have to learn the method of the teacher. Like in the Vedic system, you would go through the system. And by the time you got to the end of the system, if a student had proper ability, when he finishes, graduation simultaneously means he's a teacher. Samvartana, the graduation ceremony from the Gurukul, meant they're a snatak, they're a teacher. Now they're a respectable authority in the community. On graduation, the modern is you go through the education, then you have to go back and they have to teach you how to teach. Like that. Because it's not inherent in the process. It's not understood in the process. But in the Vedic, that has to be gotten across. So the method is there, because the difference is you live with the teacher in the Gurukul. Or the daughter is living with the parents, the children are living with the parents. So they gain the mood and method. While in the school, you're only with the teacher for a short time. You know, you may only be there for 45 minutes, an hour, and that's all you see him in the day. So how much you can gain? You know, if somebody's really powerful, you may gain something. But otherwise, as a general tendency, you don't. I mean, you think yourself, you think back over all your school years, which teachers stand out in your mind. You know, out of so many teachers, you may find one, two, three actually stand out. You felt that they were, you know, they really cared for you and really were trying to teach you. And the others, they were doing their job. You know? Yeah.
After all your education, you go back and learn how to teach.
Mm-hmm.
After those 3 years of teacher training, you still don't know how to teach.
It?
You still don't know how to teach.
Yeah. Then you have to go do it. Yeah, because it's not a relationship. This is the difficulty. See, a relationship is just like, let us say, take the situation. The child grows up in a very caring family. When that child grows up and has a family, they automatically are caring for their family because a relationship was there. So one side automatically means the other side's there. If you can be submissive, let's say you are a submissive follower, you will be able to be a dutiful or a kind leader. The two go hand in hand. If you have the propensity, if you have the ability. You know, so you don't see any good leader who's not a good follower. Like that. You know? Those who are leaders that people respect are good followers also. So you have to have both. So therefore, in the Vedic system, the idea is because you live with a teacher, they care for you, they're teaching you, they're taking that time. That relationship is established. Therefore, automatically, you know how to teach. Well, in the modern system, you may or may not. It's not required. You don't see anywhere on any, you know, brochure or anything in any educational institution that you're going to develop a close relationship with the teachers, and through that method you're going to learn. So because of that, it's not guaranteed you will learn, or even you go to the class to learn how to teach, that you've actually gotten that relationship, you gain, because they taught you how to teach, so that means you went through the process. But unless, if that relationship is there, you may gain it. But if you don't, then you won't. You know, that's the difficulty. Also in the Vedic system, another aspect that was advantageous, Prabhupada mentions, is that the teacher would teach the older students would teach the younger students. So you're already teaching within the system. That helps a lot. So many times you see some of the better students, they become, you know, in schools that have it, especially in boarding schools, they become ones that take responsibility for things in the schools. Generally, they're the ones who will more tend to become leaders in society because they've already done it in the school. So with that combination, then it becomes very good. Does that make any sense? Yeah, so it's a good point.
In the modern education system, most of the people who teach it doesn't practice. Take, for example, people who go and do MBA, got masters in business administration, they come up and learn from the professors who have never done any business before.
Yeah, yeah.
And they come up with all this MBA and they don't.
No, they know theory. Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot of teaching, but there's no learning.
Yeah, yeah. No, but they're teaching, those persons can go and work under a businessman. They can't be a businessman. They'll go work on their business.
Most of them just get a job.
They get a job. They're actually, technically, means the guy who's teaching it, he went through it and he's teaching it. He's a Brahmin.
And the person who runs the business hasn't gone to school.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the free education and his first has an MBA.
Yeah, yeah.
Master in business.
Yeah. So that guy with no education, he hires the MBA. That's the thing. It's a waste of time. Means Prabhupada mentions that the system for teaching a business person is after they go to the Gurukul and they've learned their, you know, the shastra and the culture and the character, then they're put under the charge of a relative who does business for free. Means he just goes and he works for him. That's all. So then he runs them through all the things in the business. So he cleans, he does this, he packs, he unpacks, whatever has to be done, he's doing. And then slowly, after some time, he sees that he's doing well, then he starts to give him a little money. You know, just some hand money, you know, pocket money like that. You know, do what he likes with it. So he's proven that he has the, you know, the nature to be trained and all that. And then he gives a little money. Then he's inspired because he's done work and he gets money. So he sees the benefits of it. And then he gets them right into how the business works. He teaches them the business. You know, how to sit, how to catch a customer, how to deal with the customer, how to your stocks, how to, you know, all the, whatever is the nature of the business that's there. Then once he's done that, then they can go open their own business. Prabhupada says that's how you train a businessman. Because no, I've heard it and I've said it in so many forums that even businessmen, I say there's not one businessman in the world who's been trained in a business school. Like that. People go to a business school, they're hired by businessmen. Like that. And one devotee was telling me a statistic that they did a survey on all the CEOs of all big companies in America. And all of them, they started out in the bottom. They were all the peon and the delivery boy and the guy who cleaned and like that. They started there, but because they had good attitude and the ability, then naturally one businessman can see another. So then they moved up until they came to the top of the pile. And then all those who came out of Harvard School of Business Management and those kind of things, they came in like in middle or upper middle management, and they stayed there through their whole life. They never move up. Because they only know they know the field, but they have to be engaged, because they don't really know business. They know the field of business. School can teach you the field of business, but it can't actually teach you the heart of business. That you have to get from someone else. You know, life comes from life, so business comes from business. That's why you go and live with the teacher in the school. Is because then you get from them their mood, their method, their culture. Then you become cultured. Like that. So these practical things, business can't be trained in a classroom. You know, the martial sciences can't be trained in a classroom. Arts cannot be trained in a classroom. You know, I mean academically. You have to do it. And the more it's real, the situation, then the more you actually gain in it. The verminical things can be taught in the classroom. And all the shastric aspects that a king works on, and the points of religion that everybody else works on, those can be taught in a classroom. But they must be practically applied. That's why even in the classroom, then much of it's done through histories. Because then you get a practical example of someone doing it. You understand how Yudhishthira acted in this situation, how Arjuna acted in that situation, what was Krishna's reaction to this activity or that person. Like that. It becomes practical for you. Then you can go and apply it. Like that. But like the field of the culture of the Vedic culture, society is learned by living with others who practice it. Like that. So culture is learned by practice. By living with those who practice. You can't teach it. It's like you can have a class in Vaishnava etiquette, it just makes you aware that it exists, but you can't teach Vaishnava etiquette in the classroom. You teach it practically. You want to teach, let's say, serving prasadam. You can tell all the elements that are there so everyone understands what's there. So they know that, that there is some connection between the people that are there, their plates, the buckets, spoons, and what's, in the kitchen to cook. And you have to, match that. The utensil that you're going to put the prasadam in should match what the prasadam is. You don't put dal in a tray. You can put something dry in a tray. Like that. How you serve. You don't serve. You can't serve something liquid with a slotted spoon. Like you have a wet sabji and they serve it with a slotted spoon. I mean, we laugh, but I'm giving an example because I've seen it. And it's not at all uncommon. You know, there's always you check generally the wrong spoon is in the wrong preparation. It's like a must. You know. You can't have a proper, you know, improper service without it. You know. So you can make them aware of these things, but then it's only in the practice that you can really get it across. They see how it's done. You can tell them, you know, serve like this and do like that. This is the mood of serving. But in doing it, that's when you actually catch them. So therefore, you need that combination of academic and there. Though you have to see what's the proportion. Sometimes it's very big on the academic, very small on the practical, or the other way around. The business person is giving academic knowledge. He'll say, when this kind of person comes in, then there's this many kinds of people. Okay, you're going to have this kind of customer, this kind of customer, this kind of customer. So when this one comes in, you do this. This one, then you're aware of it. Then they watch them do it. So the class may have been 1 minute long, you know, and then you know, the practicals of it may be weeks, months. Or it may be the other way around. You know, like theoretically teaching deity worship means if you want to go through it, it actually, you're talking about months or a year if you really want to know the science. But to learn the deity worship itself, you can teach it in a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Even the most technical puja. But to understand what you're doing, then you need like, you know, a year of backup of knowledge in that to do it. But other things, it's maybe the other way around. You need a year of practice and 5 minutes of knowledge.
Okay. At a local university, they're very proud that they've just introduced a new course. It's a degree in parenting.
Oh, okay. Very good.
It just shows how society's failing.
Yeah, very many people don't know, yeah. And the interesting thing would be is, are the teachers parents? You know, that's the fun thing. I many times find it very fun is that I run into so many situations where someone would be telling me how the mentality of, you know, a child or something like that, and I'll ask them if they have any, and they don't, you know, or they haven't dealt with them. You know, they have a 4-year-old daughter and they're telling me about teenagers. You know, like that. Well, you know, we've had hundreds of teenagers. So it's like, that's the interesting thing is, are those people ones that have raised successful families? You know, are they going to bring in some nice, you know, dumpy 40-year-old woman to, you know, tell them about, you know, that's raised, you know, already 8-10 kids? And this is it. Are they going to bring in some nice, you know, sleek, latest model of, you know, someone who doesn't know these things? She's already been through, you know, 50 boyfriends before, you know, coming to this program. You know, that would be interesting to check. Yeah. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srimad Prabhupada ki, Sanyasai Kumar.